Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here, 11 minutes after 12 on a Friday afternoon, a beautiful Friday afternoon, and a great Labor Day weekend ahead. Labor Day, we'll talk about labor in America coming up a little bit later in the program. First, Andrea Haines is here. She's the editor for Blue Sky Innovation in the Chicago Tribune, where they write about technology and innovation. Andrea, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be here.
Okay, so I got roped into last year getting one of these new phone contracts, which means that I guess I'm renting my phone, or I don't quite understand it, but so I'm eligible for a new iPhone every time one comes out. And one's coming out.
Yes, one appears to be coming out on Wednesday, which is September 7th. And there's perhaps a little nod there to the fact that it would be the iPhone 7 that would be announced on Wednesday.
Wink, nod, nod, right?
Yes.
Do we know much about it?
So we're starting to know a little more about it. And originally everybody was saying, oh, it's going to be nothing. It's going to be no big deal, no big upgrade. But then, you know, interesting things are starting to come out. Everyone from the Wall Street Journal to Bloomberg has had bits and pieces of what may be part of the new iPhone. And a lot of it seems to be things that are actually disappearing rather than being added.
Okay.
So the big thing that many of you may have already heard about is that the headphone jack is, you know, rumored to be going.
Right.
So it would mean, you know, wireless headphones, no more headphone jack.
Which would be big cash for people who've got headphones and would need new headphones.
Definitely. I'm a little sad, too, because I have one of those little plug-ins that, you know, goes to a little tiny travel speaker, and I use that outside and things, so I'd be a little sad to lose that. But
well, let them know. It's not too late.
Yeah. I'm sure they'll listen, right?
Okay, so that's going to go. Do we know anything else?
There are a couple other things. The Wall Street Journal has reported that the 16 gig level is going to be gone.
Okay.
You know, that used to be the lowest level of storage that you could get, and now that's just not enough for people. They, you know, we're all using phones, videos, and a million different things, so that option is said to be going away. And a third thing that is said to be going away, and we'll see on Wednesday, but the home screen where you kind of click it with your finger, it would be touch responsive, so you wouldn't have to actually click that button, that round home screen button. It would just be responsive to your touch, so the click part of it would go away.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Really?
Yeah. The home screen.
Let's show our listeners.
So we're holding our phones. I see. So there's a click
button. Yeah, the click button on the round button on
the little circle on the bottom.
The circle on the bottom. You wouldn't actually have to physically click that. Like now you get a sort of satisfying click. It would just be touch responsive.
And so right now I can do it fingerprint wise, but I still would have to click it to activate it.
Yeah, well, you still click it for various uses.
So
yeah.
Do you think that's going to make people stand in line and wait in line to get a new phone?
We're going to find out. One interesting thing they are possibly adding is a second camera that would allow for better zooming. So that would be something that would be an addition instead of a subtraction.
Right. Okay. Still, I don't know that people would. But they will, because that's who they are.
They
will. What they do. They're defined by having the latest phone. Andrew Mason is a guy who we talk about quite a bit. He was one of the founders of Groupon until he wasn't. And he's got a new venture, and I love this. It's called Detour Audio Tours. It's coming to Chicago. Explain to me what that is.
Yeah, so Andrew Mason was a founder of Groupon and was the CEO of it for many years. He left there in 2013, moved out to Silicon Valley, and he has been working on this audio tour. It's sort of a travel-related kind of thing. You visit a city, you can do an audio tour in your headphones of different neighborhoods. So they've launched other cities this week. There are now tours live in Chicago, and they're also adding more in Chicago. There are a couple now available for Chicago, but more coming soon. So you can get theme sort of tours of Grant Park, of the Loop. There's going to be one on Wicker Park. There's going to be one that's bar focused. There's some different ones coming.
I've always wanted to spend some time in Old Town with Rick Kogan.
So there's some big names leading some of the tours, which is definitely some added value. Rick Kogan, who surely all of your listeners know who that is.
Absolutely.
We'll be doing one of them, and some other local names.
I like
Richard Steele.
And Tim Samuelson. I love Tim Samuelson. He's a treasure in this city. I don't know if enough people know about him. But
yeah, and treasure's a good word for it. Some of the Chicago treasures can walk you around and tell you, you know, their insights about the neighborhood.
So do you have Andrew's number? Because I want to do one. And I've had this idea for a long time. First in book form, but now obviously it would work better this way. First of all, when you fly, like say you fly to New York, I love it when the pilot says, look out your window and see.
Yeah.
So there was actually a guy who wrote a book once to help you identify what you're seeing from the air. I think that's cool. I think people who are driving back and forth from Chicago to, say, Champaign for the U of I, I want to do a little I-57 audio tour.
Yeah.
You know, on your right is Moni. I think, what are you laughing about?
There is a cow.
There's a lot of history in Moni.
The air one would be fun, though, because don't you always think like it's some mysterious crop circle or this is where some alien invasion happened, especially when you're flying over the West.
You just mocked me a little bit, but I was kind of serious. I actually am serious.
People love history. When you're traveling, you're in that mindset. You know, you're there to appreciate the location in a different way. And I love to do things like that. I've done those in years past.
Let's hear about the famous ghost story of Buckley Loda.
Yeah,
right. People don't know that. Paxton, Illinois.
The largest ball of twine.
What's the coolest,
to hear all about it.
Coolest thing that ever happened in Ashkim, Illinois.
Yep.
Right?
On it.
So get Andrew, because I could use that gig. Speaking of that, going down I-57, let's talk a little bit about Spikeball. Now, one of the guys behind Spikeball was a Rooter kid who had his roots down in Kankakee County. These guys have been phenomenally successful, and it just keeps getting bigger and bigger for them.
Yeah, so Spikeball is this game that you may see on the beach or in other places where it's a simple two-on-two game. You spike a ball into the net. It's a fun sort of recreational game. But they've done some smart things with how they're marketing it as well. Like, they've created sort of a tournament structure around it so that people get involved in tournaments and play that way. They're getting involved in physical fitness classes. They're finding some interesting outlets for the game. And they're growing. They were on Shark Tank. They got a good sized investment there, and they're growing on the marketing side and selling tons of these things.
But they're not adding a lot of employees because of what they're doing, kind of with their back office.
Exactly. So on the back end, they are using a company that's really helping them scale. So they're not having to worry about some of the mechanics of how they're selling the product as they grow. So that's allowing them to keep the team small, which is great for a small business that's just getting started. Still,
right.
Really, even though they're doing well.
So here we are on Friday when the jobless numbers came out, and they were a little disappointing. Maybe if Spikeball hired more workers, we'd be better off.
Yeah, it's one of those two-sided stories, right? It's great for a small company that's trying to count its pennies, but it's tech jobs that are not existent anymore, I guess.
Have you ever heard of Chief Shawanossi?
I don't think I have.
Do
I need to do the tour?
You would if you'd done my tour and driven through Bourbonnais and Kankakee, Illinois. You'd know all about Chief Shawanossi. So we'll save that for another Friday.
Yeah.
Andrea Haines, have a great Labor Day weekend.
Thank you. You too.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Here on the Business Lunch, Steve Bertrand on a Friday afternoon. Are you writing the check for your property taxes? But Bottle Shaw is here in the newsroom, or in the office, I should say, the guy behind Turbo Appeal, and he has a way that might ease the sting a little bit. Bottle, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thanks for having me.
I did that right, Bottle?
That's correct.
I'm sorry. So Turbo Appeal, people get their property taxes, and, I'm one of those guys who says, I understand we've got to pay for the services we've got, but I was just actually talking to a neighbor last week about how much they pay versus how much I pay. It's really kind of difficult to understand. And I know people always say, well, you should appeal your taxes. But then it's like, well, you got to go out and you got to find comps and you got to do this paperwork. And I just think that keeps a lot of people from trying to do it. Now, you have software, a company that helps with that, right? Explain it for me.
Yeah, absolutely. So essentially what we want to do is we want to empower the homeowner with a data-driven, evidence-based solution. So really the software, and make it very simple. So, in 30 seconds, sign up, turboappeal.com. What we do is a homeowner can come to our site, they can have a quick sign up, and we essentially take care of all of the evidentiary requirements in the format that's required for that local jurisdiction.
Okay.
And what we want to do is basically put forth a real data-driven approach. We're essentially a big data analytics company, so we really crunch through the data, mine through the data. That's where our expertise is, to maximize the opportunity for a reduction.
So right now you're in Cook County, in DuPage County?
In Illinois, yes.
Okay. Are you elsewhere in the country?
We are. We're also in Florida, and
okay,
then we are in the process of rolling out to 18 states.
Will you soon be for all of Illinois?
The majority of Illinois, correct.
By when?
By the end of this year.
Because my taxes are due in April. I just want to know.
Okay. Well, by the end of this year,
I live in Lake County. So that'll. And so I sit down at the computer, sign up, put in what I have to put in?
All we need is really the property owner's name and their address.
Okay.
And we take it from there.
Not even the PIN number of the piece of property?
No, we pull that information through our data sets.
Okay. And so then you make the Do you make the appeal directly, or do you go through it and come back to me and say, Steve, nice try, but we're looking at the numbers and it's not going to work for you?
So we, you know, we essentially crunch the data, right? And so if we can find an argument based on our data, and what we do is we put homeowners in a better position, because this really is a big data problem. So our algorithm is really looking at how can we identify the best evidence. And So the majority of the cases, we are able to find some evidence. In the cases where we can't, and a home is, you know, under-assessed or truly valued correctly, then we will go back to the homeowner and say, listen, at least you should feel comfortable that you are assessed correctly.
So you wouldn't even make the appeal in that case?
There'd be no need to.
Because it'd be pretty clear.
Correct.
Okay. When you do make the appeal, you file the paper. Is it just paperwork?
It is.
I guess it's not paper, really. But
Well, it depends on the jurisdiction. So things are changing, and I think more jurisdictions are starting to move towards technology. But there are many, for example, here, yeah, it is a paper solution.
I go figure in Illinois. It's a little behind. But you submit the paper to each of the taxing districts.
Correct.
So if it happens in Cook County, it goes to the Cook County clerk, assessor. Or it goes to the assessor?
Correct.
Just one, it goes to the Cook County assessor, not to the local communities as well?
Right. So you'll go to the assessor, then you have a second opportunity at the Board of Review.
Okay. So I'm thinking, you know, I live in Deerfield, and there's each village or town has its own assessor, too. You don't go to them. You go to the county.
Correct.
Okay. So we go to the county, you make a case, and they say, no, you're not eligible. You know, we're going to turn down your appeal. One of the things that scares me is that they're going to find out that I'm really paying less taxes than I should, and it's going to end up costing me because they're going to reevaluate. Does that happen?
So it's not triggered by an appeal. There are reassessments in each county, and they're different schedules, so they can happen annually, triannually. But you're not at risk of, hey, if you appeal, there's all of a sudden going to be an opportunity for them to come back and say, well, actually.
Yeah. Right.
But it's more of there's a reassessment, so they will be coming to, you know, look at the properties, understanding the market.
So there's no reason for that. That shouldn't keep you from appealing.
Correct.
What percentage of your appeals are successful?
So we don't necessarily publish that publicly. The reason being is because there's various ways of interpreting success rates, right? So we have to be a little careful there.
Okay.
However, what I will say...
Well, what percentage do you consider successful?
So what I'll say, what we consider successful is, let's say, a large majority of our appeals have been successful. Fortunately, what I will say is that we have been successful here, and that's enabled us to roll this out nationally.
Right. So I file my appeal. They say I'm paying $600, or let's do it easier. They say I'm paying $100 more than I should. So I'd be getting $100 back. How much goes to you?
So we take 30% of the first year savings. In the example you gave, you'd actually be receiving that on depending on where you live, on a multiple year basis. So you'd be having hundreds of dollars back, but
right.
We take 30% of just the first year.
So I'm only paying a percentage to you of the first year.
Correct. And we actually are in the process of rolling out an additional flat fee product, a nominal flat fee to really help all homeowners at a very nominal fee.
Why would I guess that's sort of a risk then, right? Because if the nominal fee is greater than the 30%, you end up losing money, right? Or if it's so...
Correct. So there's different segments that look at it. In some cases, the 30% can actually be a substantial amount,
right,
because
right,
the reduction
sure.
is very large.
Right.
If you look at a nominal fee, you know, somewhere in the range of $25 to $50, many homeowners are willing to pay that to, one, ensure they're at fair market value, and then, two, is, of course, if they have the reduction, keep the majority of that in their pocket.
Well, I love the idea, and that's the way it works if you hire a lawyer or whatever, too. You give a percentage to them to file the appeal, so it seems to be worth the trade because it's money coming back to you one way or another that you weren't going to have otherwise. Well, listen, congratulations with this bottle, and when will the national rollout come? I mean, it seems like a big deal. You couldn't do that in a year or so, can you?
We're actually, by the end of this year, we'll be rolling out nationally.
And so we can just sit at our computer and appeal our property taxes.
That is correct.
The assessors are going to love you.
We hope so.
Where do people get more information?
www.turboappeal.com.
Turboappeal.com. Great. Thanks for coming by. I appreciate it. I think you're going to change the way we pay our property taxes.
Appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
You bet. It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on this Friday afternoon on 720 WGN. Are you in a union? Do you have a union job? Chances are you don't, and neither does your neighbor. They did more likely have a union job in the 1970s, but those jobs have dwindled pretty dramatically since the 70s. But here's the question. If you did have a union job or if your neighbor had one, would you be making more money today in your non-union job? There was a study out this week that said probably. Alexia Alejalde Ruiz is a writer for the Chicago Tribune, and she wrote about that study, and she joins us now on the Business Lunch. Alexia, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so let's start just with the numbers, the fact that how many people are working union jobs now compared to how many did, say, in the 1970s?
So in the late 70s, it was about 34% of men were in unions and about 16% of women, and that's declined to about 10% for both men and women today.
And, you know, unions, you always hear about the bad part of them, and that, you know, I can't do this. The union contract says I don't have to. I'm not going to work this day, blah, blah, blah. But the fact is that the union jobs tended to be, I guess they tended to escalate all of our salaries, right? That's the point of this story.
Right. So when you have that bargaining power, you can, you know, lobby for higher wages, and then that and everybody's ships rise or whatever that, that
right.
saying is.
Rising tide lifts all boats.
There you go. Thank you. Yeah. So basically, unions allow people to negotiate for higher wages, and then that kind of sets an industry standard so that non-union employers have to meet that same wage in order to attract talent or in order to avoid their workers from forming a union and, you know, bringing all the annoying things that having a union can have.
All the downsides.
And so they just, you know, will also kind of match that wage to kind of discourage workers from getting agitated.
But so one of the things we always hear is that, you know, if the unions go away and businesses prosper, that everyone will then make more money. And that doesn't seem to be what this study dictates, right, or tells us.
Right. So this is suggesting that has not happened, and in fact that some of the wage stagnation and the income inequality that we're paying so much attention to today is in part a result of the weakness of unions.
So if we had those pesky unions around more, the wage stagnation wouldn't exist as much. I mean, they talk about jobs going overseas and all of that. I mean, those are certainly factors, too.
Right. So they say that, you know, oftentimes when you talk about wages staying flat and income inequality, you talk about globalization and offshoring and technology taking over some jobs and just education, you know, not doing so well.
Right.
But they're saying that this is a sliver of it that doesn't get talked about as much. And they quantified it, and they said basically that if unions had remained as strong as they were in the late 1970s, in 1979 specifically, that for men, wages would be about $2,700 higher annually than they are now, and particularly for less educated men with a high school diploma or less, they'd be most impacted because they're the ones who tended to be in
the union.
Union jobs, right.
And this study was done by the Economic Policy Institute.
That's correct.
Which tends to look out for middle and lower income people, right?
That's right. It's kind of a progressive.
Okay, so we've got that going for us. But there's not been a lot of blowback to it, has there?
Not that I have seen.
Right, and so is, what's the solution here? More unionization? I don't think that's going to happen.
Well, there's not a super, well, so it's interesting, actually, what's happening with unions right now. On the one hand, you have Rauner, you know, and those
policies.
Well,
that's the thing. So when you think, first of all, I was kind of struck that in the 70s, the number of men in unions greatly outweighed the number of women, right?
Right.
And but now it's kind of equal by gender, about 10%, right?
Right.
Men and women.
Yeah.
And then so I'm assuming really that most of those are public sector jobs. Is that fair?
Yes, definitely. So this study focused on the private sector jobs. Public sector unionization is much more common. And the areas in which unions are growing in the private sector, service sector, you know, the fight for 15, they're not unionized. You know, the fast food workers are not actually represented by unions, but there's almost this kind of like alternative union representation
right.
of people fighting on their behalf. Faculty unionization has been taking off. So there are like little sectors like that where unions seem to be growing, but there's also kind of in the broader private sector space a decline.
The Fight 15, that's a great example. So say you own a sandwich shop and you're next door or in the neighborhood with these other unionized, you know, if this results in a union, unionized McDonald's workers who are making $15 an hour, that's going to be harder for you to pay your workers $10 an hour because they can go across the street and make it there at McDonald's. So then the wages at your sandwich shop probably would go up. I mean, in a nutshell, that's what we're talking
about.
That's
the theory.
Right. And which would be bad for me if I'm running the sandwich shop.
It's bad for, yeah. Well, yeah. So business owners would say that's bad for me and that's bad for the customers because they're going to have to raise the prices of the food, but it's good for the workers. Maybe in the end, that's good for the business if you have happier workers and people who can afford to support themselves.
And maybe better for the country too, if we, you know, if, I mean, because clearly this wage stagnation, the fact that we're making dramatically less now in real dollars than we were in the 70s. I mean, if the money from business success was supposed to come down to the workers, that hasn't happened.
Right.
And so maybe this is a way to make it happen a little bit more. Well, I'm going to go get a union sign and walk around downtown this afternoon.
It probably wouldn't be bad for us over here in this communications industry.
Yeah, right. We need to unionize. So when we hear of the unions, we hear by and large about the negative stuff. And I think a lot of that is earned. I mean, I think there is a lot of negative stuff that these guys bring on their own, but there are some positive. And I just thought this was an interesting story because there are positives, not just for the workers in that union, but for all of the rest of us as well.
Right.
And do you think people will take this information then and make anything change?
No, I don't think. I mean, it's not totally new. News, you know, that unionization helps, you know, raises wages across the board, and there are so many people on the other side of it who are saying no, you know, and that unions are do more bad damage than good. And so I don't know if this is going to make a difference, but I do think that there is a lot of movement right now on raising minimum wage and on just kind of workers' rights, and people are paying attention to it because the inequality has become so glaring that maybe there will be kind of a renewed push for organizing.
Like, and the way you put it, then maybe the minimum wage has become the new union contract in a way.
Yeah.
A lesson. When you brought up Governor Rauner earlier, so moving against unions, so I mean, we're 10% now. Maybe if we talk in 10 years, it might be down to 5 or 6 or 7%.
I don't know. You know, it'll be interesting to see which direction it goes in. But yeah, if there's more, if the push has become successful to tamp down on unions, then yeah, it could go that direction. But it doesn't look like it's going to happen in Illinois.
Alexia Holliday Ruiz, thanks very much for coming by. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Ella Holliday, I said that correctly. And listen, we've got a union guy coming to open the door for you to leave. So if you don't mind just staying in your seat.
Because he's not going to be here for like another 5 minutes.
Well, he's on his break. He gets a break. So I hope you understand that. It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thank you, Orion. It's 12:52, the Business Lunch on 720 WGN, a Friday ahead of Labor Day weekend. So we're talking about union jobs a little bit. But most of us, if we're not outside enjoying the great weather, we're just going to be sitting inside, huddled, and playing on Facebook, right? That's what Americans do anymore. That's what the world does. Niall Nickel is on the phone line. He is the president and CEO of Balance Engines. Niall, thanks for joining us on the Business Lunch.
Hey, it's absolutely great to be with you, Steve.
All right, so the idea is that, well, I've just figured that no matter what I click on or do or follow when it comes to Facebook or other social media, that data is going somewhere evil and it's being shared with people that I don't necessarily want to have it shared with. Is that a fair or unfair assumption?
Well, that's about as fair as you could get. And not only is it going somewhere, it's going multiple somewheres. You know, one of the things that I find is funny is you click on some product that you're absolutely not interested in, just about anywhere on the web, and it'll follow you.
Yeah, well, so I did that just last week. I was in the market for it was a grooming product, and I was trying to find something, and I clicked on an article that recommended different varieties, and then went to the website of one that was recommended, and now every time I'm online, I see an ad for this one particular sort of body wash or things like that. So that will now follow me for what, for the rest of my life or for how long?
Well, it will probably follow you for about 30 days, but many marketers use this. It's called ad retargeting. They use it to track somewhere between 30 to 90 days, and they figure if you haven't bought after 90 days, they could probably drop you out of the sequence, but it'll be following you for a while.
So when they do that, when they decide to follow me, are they paying a premium to sort of zone in on me, or is it just part of their bigger deal that this is just the way it works?
Well, it's really part of their bigger deal, and believe it or not, they're paying less to zoom in you on you specifically because they're not going to a big broad market. They're going to a market that has expressed interest in their product. So it actually costs them less per click than it would if they were going to a broad market advertisement.
Interesting. And so, I mean, that's the sort of thing where if you're trying to get business leads, it refers to the quality of the lead. They're getting a pretty quality lead from me if they know that I've been shopping for something similar to their product.
Oh, absolutely. You're not talking about trying to talk somebody into your product. You're talking about maybe getting them to buy your product when they've already expressed interest. Huge difference.
And so is this a bad thing or is this a good thing? I mean, look, I was looking for something like this, and why not have this presented to me as a possibility every single time I log on?
Well, it's a good thing until you buy, because after you buy, it still keeps following you, which could be annoying. And it's not so much the fact that it's a good thing because you're interested in the product. It's now what they do with that data. They now sell that to third parties that aggregate the data, and you get on those lists for other products that you may not be interested in at all. And it really lets them sort of zoom in on your preferences and really gain sort of an unfair advantage.
Well, that's the unfair advantage, is when they zoom in on something that's not my preferences. I'm like, I just checked it out. I don't really want to buy this car, but now I'm being overwhelmed with it. So tell me about these third-party websites, then. Is this something we should be concerned about?
Well, the third-party websites are really unregulated, and the thing that's most shocking to me is a number of them are not in the U.S. A number of them are in China, Russia, overseas. And, you know, you now start to question, what do they really want all of this data for? What are they doing with it?
What are they doing with it? Do we know?
Well, you know, in this case, what has been determined thus far is they're trying to form your opinions on certain things. For example, if there's a trade deal with the U.S. and China, China may want to influence and advertise certain articles to you that don't look like an advertisement. It's not a product at all, but it may influence the way you think on this, and hence may influence what happens in Congress related to some of the actions that might go on.
Okay, now that sounds really nefarious and dangerous and all of that stuff, but isn't that really what happens to us every day, all the time anyway, whether it's editorial writers writing articles or advertisers on TV or here on radio or in magazines? I mean, they're trying to make their point and sell their product. So this is just another way of doing it, but it's a little more zeroed in because of they know our preferences.
Well, that's exactly the difference. It's not a little bit more zeroed in. It's a lot more zeroed in. So they could really influence the outcome of many events. And, you know, now you start to question, listen, if it's domestically, maybe we're not as worried about it. It's part of business.
But wait, so are you telling me
to happen internationally?
Are you telling me that you think
story?
Are you telling me that you think that U.S. policy could be impacted by the sort of body wash I click on in my Facebook ads?
I'm not telling you. I'm guaranteeing you. It absolutely can be, because it's not that one action you took. It's a multiple number of actions you took, and now they get a really tightly focused demographic estimate of you, and they know exactly how they talk to you. And, of course, there's tens of thousands of views, but they have messages that are crafted just for that audience.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. I'm glad you joined us today, because when we started out, I wasn't sure. You don't have me convinced yet now, but you got me thinking, because it's not a sort of thing I had considered before. I'm going to look into it a little bit more. Maybe we can talk about it again in the future.
Sounds absolutely great, and be happy to.
Niall Nickel is the president and CEO of Balance Engines. Thanks very much. Enjoy your holiday weekend.
And the same to you and your listeners.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN.